Hey everyone, it is Sam again. First, I would like to apologize for the delay in getting the 8th and 9th letters to you guys. I suppose I owe you a bit of an explanation. So, here's what happened. In mid-September, I got invited to be a leader for a sort of training seminar. Essentially, some order hunters are interested in establishing a more formal training program for some of the newer, less experienced members of our organization. They arranged for us to do an extended wilderness training seminar in southern Utah. My job was about helping teach and supervise the students. We did all sorts of lessons on hunter work, from tracking to advanced survival skills to weapons training. We also did lots of book work, going over case studies, field reports, and post-action write-ups. A lot more paperwork than you might think goes into being a hunter, although our guides handle most of it. On the training, we even brought out a psychologist to talk about and prepare people for abstract parts of capital H hunting. Lots of hunters have mental illness and psychological problems because of our work, and although I do not talk about it much, I have suffered a lot of these as well. It is great to see the hunters making a more active effort to address this, although I still cannot help but wish we had made this effort earlier. That is part of what this letter will be about, but we will get into that later. In any case, we were pretty much off the grid for this training. That was the point of the goal, to get the students more acclimated to those type of environments and conditions where they would often be working for extended periods of time. So, no beds, internet, or cell phone signal for the duration of the training, just like how it would usually be on a task. That is why I have been gone for so long, in a nutshell anyway. But I do not expect too many more situations like that for the foreseeable future, so there should not be any more major holdups. However, this is the second to last letter that I agreed upon with Swamp Dweller. So as sad as it may be, you will probably have to wait for one more letter after this. With that being said, let us get straight into the Q&A for this letter, so I can get to a few more of your questions before I go. I know I will not be able to answer everything, but hopefully I can address some of the more common or more important questions. So, let us start. Have I ever encountered any cryptids that act as guardians over a particular area? Yes, I have, actually. Many types of fairy fall into this category, since they are very protective of certain groves of trees, bodies of water, or especially hills and mounds. I have also mentioned Nixies in the past, which are beings connected to specific rivers and streams, which they will often defend quite aggressively. And of course, many cryptids are only plain territorial, and will defend a certain area or home range. What do I think the Mothman really is? To tell you the truth, I do not know much about the Mothman, and neither do the hunters. There are only a few recorded sightings in our files, and never any close encounters. However, I tend to believe that this is just a species of worldly creature. I do not think it is demonic or supernatural. It is probably just a species of powerful winged humanoid, of which there are a few others. Maybe it is related to owls somehow, but who knows. In any case, it is a weird and interesting cryptid, but since it does not appear to be actively dangerous, our organization is not terribly interested in it. Have I ever had any experiences with shadow people or demons? Demons, no. Shadow people, yes. I once saw a shadow person at my school when I was a teenager. Nothing overly exciting, though. It was just a human-shaped, adult-sized shadow that walked across a room from one side to the other. However, I know that shadow people are quite commonly seen, and hunters do not typically deal with them. It is hard to deal with something intangible, and since shadow people do not seem to seriously harm humans on a large scale, we tend to focus our efforts on more physical beings. However, there are some hunters who specialize in dealing with intangible creatures. I have never really been involved with that side of our organization, so I do not know much about it. But I can certainly reach out and try to get some more information. Have I ever been on a hunt that I regret? Only one. And that is the story I'm going to tell you now. This time, we are going to be talking about one of the rarest and most dangerous monsters on the planet. The Washougae. There are not many creatures in this world that I actively dislike, cryptid or otherwise. But I may make an exception for Washuge. And I fear them more than almost any other monster. Like with the word Wendigo, the plural of the word Washuge is the same as the singular. There's no S's at the end, but the similarities between Wendigo and Washuge go beyond just the rules of their names. Both are creatures from the mythologies of native peoples of the northern United States and Canada. Both are living representations of ice, snow, hunger, and starvation. And both have insatiable, bottomless appetites for flesh, especially of humans. In the legends of the Dene Zaha people, a Washuge is the result of a human who was possessed by one of the great spirit animals and became overwhelmed by their power. I do not know if this is true or not, but in any case the hunters have no definitive answers as to the origins of the Washuge. Just like in many other cases, the old tales are the best information we have got. Whether their origins are human or not, Washuge are humanoid in appearance. They stand between 8 and 15 feet tall and have disproportionately long arms that end in hands with immense claws. Their feet simply resemble larger versions of human feet, much like Wendigo feet. Unlike Wendigo, however, Washuge are covered with fur, usually gray or jet black in color, flowing out like a mane. Washuge heads are skulls, oversized versions of the bones of predatory animals. Washuge typically have wolf skulls or heads, but have also been seen with bear and lynx skulls. The fangs of these skulls are typically oversized and clearly designed as weapons. These fangs are the primary neutral weapons of Washuge, along with their claws and their almost supernatural speed, strength, and cunning. Washuge seem to be active only in the winter and travel with the snows and storms of Canada and the northern U.S. Perhaps because of this climate they live in and hunt in, Washuge have one more natural method of both attack and defense. As if they weren't already dangerous and powerful enough, Washuge seem to have some affinity for ice itself. They will often appear with thick layers of ice coating parts of their bodies like armor, or with enormous icicles protruding from their fur-like spines. This ice is unusually strong and durable, and functions like armor or weaponry. In most cases, fire is the only strong countermeasure to this aspect of Washuge. In terms of their lifestyle, Washuge seem to behave much like Wendigo or tall deer. Washuge are constantly ravenous predators, with an existence that seems to revolve entirely around hunting, killing, and eating. Hunters have only ever observed these monsters on the attack, striking out from blizzards and snowstorms to slaughter and devour their prey. Washuge seem to eat anything that has a heartbeat, but they actively seek out and target humans in particular. Because of this, Washuge are among the most dangerous creatures to us, and the hunters have a kill-on-sight mandate for them. They are a threat to all other living creatures, and have the power to destabilize entire ecosystems. As brutal as it might seem, it is to protect both humans and the environment that hunters will not hesitate to slay Washuge. It is not easy or pleasant, but there is no mercy when it comes to these monsters. I learned this lesson for myself in the winter of 2008. Around this time, jobs in Canada had been increasing in number, and lots of these tasks had proven to be pretty lucrative and fulfilling for me and Heather. To get closer to the action, we made the decision to move further north onto a plot of land in Washington State, near the Canadian border. We also were not too far away from where my father lives, so it was nice to still be close to family. I've always liked Washington a lot, and it was exciting to introduce Heather to my dad, show her around some of the areas of the state that I had visited before. Our house was also great, being situated on a slope in some high forest, not far from a lake with mountains in the distance. It was a beautiful place, especially in the fall when parts of the forest became yellow and orange and red like wildfire. One of those autumn days, I thought about taking Heather to one of the ridges that overlooked the lake and asking her to marry me. I never did. I think it's because we both have never felt like taking that extra step was honestly all that necessary. We knew that we loved each other, and that was always going to be enough. I also think I've always been a bit scared of such a permanent contract. Being a hunter, it's so easy to lose everything in an instant. So, in any case, I never proposed to Heather at the ridge over the lake, although from time to time I still think about it. It is a pretty magical place. We spent a lot of time there and in other parts of the woods around our house in between jobs. There were not any cryptids in the area, or at least not any that we ever found. And there were no trails either, so nobody ever interrupted our alone time or otherwise bothered us. All in all, it was a great place to rest, recuperate, and de-stress in between our task, which is really the best you can hope for in a home when you're a capital H hunter. Heather and I had been living in our house for quite a while when the winter of 2008 arrived. And along with it, an urgent request from the lodge administration in Saskatchewan. When Sergio informed me of the distress call, I remember feeling a physical chill run through my body. It was just like the situation with the Wendigo a few years earlier, and if you have ever heard my previous letters on that topic, then you'll know that that was not a pleasant experience. And this one seemed to be shaping up to be even worse. Several dead humans and large animals had been found in woodland areas, their deaths coinciding with snowfall and high winds. The corpses were little more than scraps of clothing or fur, along with bloodstains on the snow. All of the bodies had been completely devoured. The manner of the killings could have been the work of a few types of monster, including Wendigo, but the relationship to weather patterns pointed to something even more disturbing. Washuge. To tell you the truth, when I heard that, I was hesitant to take the job. I thought back to my Wendigo hunt and got a nasty, sick feeling. This time, we were going after something even more dangerous, and instead of Zack, it might be me or Heather. My mother had told me repeatedly that there is no shame in turning down a job if you're not prepared for it. After all, it's your life on the line. And I have turned down some jobs in the past, whether it was due to lack of experience, lack of knowledge, lack of preparation, or whatever else. In this case, however, there were many other lives on the line besides mine. There was Heather's. There were the lives of any other hunters who might answer the call for help. But there were also the lives of all the other people and animals that the Washuge would take if it wasn't brought down as soon as possible. Being in a position where you have to weigh lives like this is a terrible burden, but hunters have to make these sorts of calculations with every task they take on. In this case, I am still not sure whether I made my calculation correctly. I told Sergio that I would get back to him as soon as I could, and then sat down to talk things over with Heather. We had always been quite open with our thoughts and feelings to each other, so we had no problem talking about this situation. We have had this same type of discussion before about other jobs, so we sat on the couch in the family room to talk it over. I don't remember who shared their feelings first, but I know that Heather felt the same way that I did. She loved me like I loved her, and never wanted to put me in danger, but she was also wanting to do everything she could to protect others and fulfill her duty as a hunter. We took each other's hands and sat in silence for a minute before calling Sergio back and letting him know that we were going to take up the hunt. Only a short time later, Heather and I were in a remote hunting lodge in the woodlands of Saskatchewan. When I say remote, I mean it. The only way to get to the lodge was to fly in on a float plane or seaplane, landing on top of the lake that the lodge was situated on. In the winter, when these lakes froze over, the planes exchanged their floats for skis and land on the ice. With this method, we were able to land safely and get to the lodge. There were no roads for miles, much less towns, but a group of reckless winter hunters had just gone missing in the area. Combined with a recent snowstorm near the lodge, this seemed like the perfect place to rendezvous and start the hunt for the Washuge. When we arrived, there were already two hunters at the lodge. They introduced themselves as Phil and Dana. Phil looked like your typical mountain man type, with broad shoulders and a dark beard that was mostly gray. Dana was pretty young, with blonde hair and lots of tattoos. Both were Canadian hunters from the general central Canadian region. Nikki arrived soon after me and Heather. She was either Asian or Native in heritage, but I never asked. As soon as she arrived, we started plans for the hunt. Thankfully, there were some maps of the area at the lodge, so each of us grabbed one. The maps had been updated within the last 2 years, so we hoped that they'd still be reasonably accurate. The hunters who had gone missing had last checked in from somewhere to the east, the same direction which the snowstorm had come. The storm had then veered south and disappeared into the woods there. With that being our best lead, we all agreed to start our search by heading south. To cover more ground, we made the choice to split into two groups. Heather and I would be one, the rest of our team would be the other. To stay in contact, Dana provided Heather with a radio and carried a matching one herself. In the forest, the radios would have a clear signal for around 3.5 miles apart. Any further than that and the connection would get spotty. The hunting lodge also had a satellite phone which Phil grabbed. This would allow us to communicate with the outside world without having to get a landline or somewhere with a cell phone signal, since we were so far away from either of those. But if the Washougae continued to head south, then it would eventually come to towns, and to more humans than just hunters and campers. That was what we were going to prevent. We set out from the lodge in the late afternoon hours, immediately splitting into the two teams to increase our chances of finding any sign. It was not long before Heather and I came across a big stretch of ruined forest, with lots of downed trees and broken branches. It was like a bulldozer or an angry Ameletuka had come through the woods. This was definitely the work of the Washougae. We radioed the other hunters and met up in the destroyed woods before following the trail southwards. After a mile or so, the damaged foliage became less and less, and the snow coating on the ground became less thick. It got easier to walk through the snow, and a trail of enormous human-like footprints gradually came into view in front of us. We did not stop to take measurements. We knew that we were on the right trail and did not want to lose time. We moved at a good pace for as long as we could, because we wanted to make use of the light. But as the sun started to set, we found a campsite in the trees and settled in for the night. The forest was quiet except for the creaking and rustling of the trees in the wind. This is not anything unusual for this environment in the wintertime, but it is more than a little creepy with the knowledge that the Washougae was out there somewhere. We took turns on watch, and the atmosphere was tense. Nobody joked around or told stories, and we did not want to talk much beyond what was necessary. It could have just been that Phil, Dana, and Nikki were just always quiet by nature, but I think we were all just on edge and anxious. I know that's how I felt, at least. I don't remember having either dreams or nightmares that night, but I did not sleep well. We did not bring individual tents. Instead, we chose to build one big circus-style tent, shelter out of tarps that we tied together and lashed to the trees. We each slept in our own individual sleeping bags beneath the shelter while one of us stood on watch outside. It was warmer in the shelter despite being freezing outside, so I was physically comfortable. Mentally, however, my thoughts were racing, thinking about everything I had heard about Washougae and everything that I knew about them. I was able to use some of the calming techniques I had learned over the years to settle myself. But then I would look over to Heather's sleeping bag in the dark and get worried about her. It was a rough night, and when we woke up in the early morning, I still felt tired. It was a bit of relief to get going on the hunt again. I felt better with something to do, and I quickly got in the zone by continuing to track our target. Sometime in the early afternoon, the trail led us to a bear den in the hillside, with a messy scene at its entrance. The snow was churned up and splashed red with blood. Here and there, chunks of ice stuck out of the snow and clumps of brown and black hair were strewn around. Bear and Washougae prints were muddled up together and mixed everywhere. But only one set of tracks left the area, and I'm sure you can guess whose those were. Even woken up from hibernation, a grizzly bear is one hell of a fighter. And yet, the Washougae had killed and eaten this one entirely, including the bones. I do not know if any of us were really surprised, but the whole scene certainly didn't make us any more confident. After assessing the area, we moved on. The Washougaish Trail soon led to a frozen river, which we walked along for a few more hours. At some point along our trek, there was a sudden, huge commotion from somewhere off to our right side, the northwest. Through the trees came barking, yipping, and crying that I quickly realized were the sounds of wolves. Wolves that were terrified. "Guns up!" someone shouted, but I had already gotten the memo. I whipped out my rifle and aimed it toward the tree line, squinting in the fading light to search for any sign of movement. The wolves were still barking at something, and a few seconds later we heard what it was. The Washougaish cry started out as a high-pitched shrieker scream, before deepening into a bestial roar that shook my chest and the ground underfoot. The roar stopped after a few more seconds, followed by branches crashing and the snapping of trees as the Washougaish rushed through them. A few seconds later, everything went silent. "We need to move," Heather spoke up after a tense minute of quiet. We all grabbed our packs and continued down the river, moving as fast as we could. By the time we found a ridge to camp on, the sun had almost set completely. We decided to put two people on watch that night instead of one, but none of us really slept well anyways. I kept having that same nightmare of the Washougaish ripping into our shelter, clawed hands reaching out. I would wake up and roll over to look at Heather, who was of course in the same spot lying quietly next to me in her own sleeping bag. The last time this happened, she was awake, and she just reached out to hold my hand. I took it, and after that I slept a bit better. At least until Nikki burst into the shelter in the dead of night. "It's snowing," she said with fear audible in her voice. We all armed ourselves and rushed outside to where Nikki and Phil were standing, looking out into the darkness. The wind had started to pick up, its whooshing and rattling of the tree branches blocking out the other sounds. The fire had gone out, and the only light came from our headlamps. The moon was blocked out by clouds, and true to Nikki's word, snow had begun to fall. At first, I could see the individual snowflakes, but in what felt like seconds, the snow was coming down in sheets, blocking off both sight and sound. Phil took a few steps out toward the tree line, fiddling with the night vision goggles on his face. "I can't see a dang thing. I don't like this," he said after a minute. "Bad weather doesn't equal an attack, necessarily," Dana suddenly said, but that didn't make things feel any better. "Let's stay quiet and keep listening," Heather put in, and I felt proud when everyone followed her suggestion. I do not know how long after this point it was that Phil got hit, but I would guess it was only a minute or two. I just remember was all of us waiting, trying to see anything through the snow. Then something moved in the darkness, and there was a low thumping sound. Phil collapsed into the snow, and the rest of us immediately opened fire in the direction of the movement. A distorted howl echoed over the gunshots, and for a brief moment, the incendiary rounds we were firing lit up the silhouette of a colossal figure as they impacted. Then the snow swirled again, and the Washougaish vanished. I glanced over to see Phil. He was still collapsed, blood soaking into the snow around him and his crumpled form. "Keep your eyes up! I'm checking Phil!" I called out before going over to Phil and crouching next to him. An enormous icicle, maybe 3 feet long, had been speared through the lower portion of Phil's chest cavity, going in through the front and emerging in a bloody spike from his back. His breathing was uneven and ragged, and from the position of the icicle and the amount of blood that drenched his clothing and the snow around him, it was painfully clear that this was the end for him. All I could say was, "I'm sorry." Phil started to say something, but between the wind, his gasping, and the blood leaking from his mouth, I could not understand much. All I could make out was the word, "Finish," before he went silent. After a few more choking gurgles, Phil went silent again, and this time, he stayed that way. "Phil's dead," I stated, standing and taking a look at everyone. They were definitely still on edge, and Dana looked like she was in shock. "What's our next move? Wait for it to come back?" Nikki asked. "It might come back for Phil, or it might be wary of our guns," Heather noted. I took a second to think. I remember looking at my watch and figuring that we had a few hours until daylight. Our target didn't seem to prefer the day or the night. It was likely just as active no matter what time it was. In any case, it was still snowing, and it didn't feel safe to keep moving while that continued. Where would we even go? But on the other hand, we weren't going to last long in the cold without the protection of a fire, a shelter, or our sleeping bags. And on top of all of this, we didn't know where the Washugae was. We might try ambushing it, Nikki finally suggested. I looked from her to Heather, who shrugged. We could move Phil to the hollow at the bottom of this ridge. The Washugae will have to be down there to get him. We hide in the ridgeline and fire on the bastard when he comes, Heather put in. It sounded like the best plan we had, so we took it. While Heather stayed with Dana to soothe her and get her moving, Nikki and I half-carried and half-dragged Phil's body down the ridge and into the hollow. I felt a little sick for using Phil as bait, and I resolved that I would do my best to keep the Washugae from eating him. It felt like the least I could do for him in this situation. We put Phil's body a few hundred yards into the hollow at the bottom of the ridge where we camped on. The only way to get to the body would be to come through the entrance of the hollow, straight in. Once we were finished positioning Phil, we regrouped with Heather and Dana. Dana was looking much better, so we put her with Nikki as a partner. The two of them stayed on the ridgeline where the camp was, in the trees overlooking the hollow. Heather and I went to the other side of the area and positioned ourselves on the opposite ridgeline. We could not see our partners, but we could see Phil in the entrance of the hollow. We all had clear shots. When the Washugae came, we'd be ready. I'm used to waiting in silence for long periods, but that night, I was on edge the whole time. It felt like the Washugae might hurl another icicle at any moment, spearing another one of us like it had impaled Phil. I felt like a total rookie, but I did my best to keep breathing, and every so often, Heather and I would squeeze each other's shoulders. Never once did I see any trace of fear in her eyes or body language. She had always been the better hunter, and that night, I could see it. After what felt like hours of waiting, the Washugae appeared at the entrance to the hollow below us. The light was horrible between the snow and the lack of moonlight, and since we had our headlights turned off to remain hidden, all I saw was a slightly darker patch of shadow move behind the curtain of snow. Heather tapped me on my right shoulder as I saw this, and we both began to ready our rifles. Maybe about a minute later, two glowing eyes came into view through the snow, more than 10 feet above the ground. Slowly, the eyes moved forward and the shadowy form of the Washugae came with them. The monster moved silently as a ghost, and I could only guess that the wind was drowning out its sounds. Slowly and deliberately, it walked towards Phil's body, and when it had almost gotten to there, Heather and I were ready to raise our guns and shoot at it. Just as I was taking aim at the head of the silhouette, either Nikki or Dana fired first from across from us. The Washugae took a step backwards, whipping its head to look around to the opposite ridgeline. I squeezed the trigger and gunfire rang out from both sides of the hollow. For a brief moment, flames from our incendiary rounds burst out across the Washugae's chest. In the firelight, I saw glistening ice and black fur, and the momentary silhouette of the saber teeth and wolf skull that were the Washugae's head. An instant later, the monster vanished back into the snow, and I heard its howl come from somewhere off to the left. Heather and I sprang up and turned on our headlamps. "It's going to be light soon. I say we follow it," I said. Ordinarily, between the snow and leaving our supplies behind, I would not have suggested this. But right now, we'd hurt the Washugae, and I didn't want to lose this chance and this advantage. Heather seemed to think for a second before replying. "Are you sure?" she asked. Her hesitation made me briefly question what I had said. Like I had thought about earlier, she was the better hunter. But something else inside of me was shouting that we needed to press our advantage. We were too close to lose our target now. "Yes, this is our chance," I answered, meeting Heather's eyes under the shine of her headlamp. She was silent for a moment before she nodded. "Right then, I'll radio the other two and we can track this thing down," she said. The sky started to brighten as we began following after the Washugae. A few minutes was all it took for Heather and I to find the cryptid's trail in the deep snow. After radioing this over to Dana and Nikki, we made it a few hundred feet before the wind picked up, blowing clouds of snow into our path. In a matter of seconds, it was a total whiteout, with nothing visible past a foot or so. I stopped dead in my tracks, my mind screaming that I made the wrong choice. I felt my heart thumping a million beats per minute, and my stomach sinking. Heather's voice rang out in my ears. "Listen," she called. I strained my ears to pick up anything besides the howling of the wind. For what felt like forever, there was nothing else. And then from my 1 or 2 o'clock, I heard the unmistakable crunch of snow. Heather and I immediately turned our guns raised as I spun around. Something slammed into my back left leg, stabbing into my calf. I dropped to the snow, feeling cold pain shoot through my leg. I didn't even need to look to know that I had been hit by another icicle that the Washuge had thrown. Doing my best to ignore the freezing pain, I fired a few shots in the direction we had heard the noise coming from before. Heather had already done the same, and I saw her aiming in a different direction, out of the corner of my eye. Branches snapped from the left, and Heather and I both hit the ground to avoid any icicles, but the Washuge was finished with ranged combat. In one impossibly fast movement, the snow whirled and the Washuge burst out of the white emptiness to my right, a completely different direction that either Heather or I were expecting. We whipped our rifle barrels around to take aim, but I realized that we were just too slow. It happened too fast for me to fire, too fast for me to make a difference. The Washuge stood up to its full height. Heather fired a single shot, and then the monster swung one enormous clawed hand. Heather was thrown backwards into the snow at the base of a tree, but my gaze didn't even follow her. Each one of the countless times I've replayed these few seconds in my mind, it always happens in slow motion, and I can't believe that even my eyes were too slow to follow Heather as she fell. But like I said, it just happened too fast for me to act, too fast for me to save her. Heather's blood splashed across the snow and I closed my eyes and fired. Heather's last shot had knocked the Washuge off balance. She had given me a perfect opening, and I took it, squeezing the trigger again and again as if shooting my rifle was the only thing I knew how to do. The sparks and heat from the incendiary rounds lit up the Washuge's long mane like a torch, and before I ran empty, my last shot clipped bone off of the monster's skull. My first shot staggered the creature, and by the third or fourth, it was screaming a high-pitched cry. Its right eye went dim, the yellow glow guttering out to leave only a black socket. Then the Washuge was gone, its shrieking and the glow of the flames vanishing into the snow. I didn't even think about following it. I feel like a bad hunter saying that now, but at the time, I wasn't thinking purely like a hunter. I was thinking like a human. Before I reached Heather, I knew what I was going towards. I was hoping with everything that I was wrong, that maybe some miracle had occurred, but I think I knew what I was going to find. I limped over to the tree where Heather had impacted to find her struggling to sit up against the tree trunk. I helped her do so and realized that she was still clutching her rifle somehow. I put the gun in her lap and looked up at her and confirmed my fears. Heather's lower torso had been slashed by the Washuge's claws and blood drenched her clothing and the snow around her. The wounds weren't even terribly deep, but they were long, and there was no way we would be able to stop the blood loss in time. There was nothing I could do to save her. I think Heather already knew this too, because she just looked into my eyes and lifted her hands to hold my face. She was too weak to say anything, and for my part, all I remember saying were the words, "Heather, I'm sorry," over and over. At some point, she put a finger to my lips and I stopped speaking. She took my face in her hands again and I could see, in her face and in her eyes, she was calm. I think she wanted me to be calm too. I nodded and she gave me a sad smile. Then her storm gray eyes drifted closed and her hands fell from my face, leaving only her blood on my cheeks. I gave her one last kiss on the forehead and hugged her. I didn't care about the blood soaking through my jacket and my pants. I just didn't want to let her go. I don't know how long I sat there holding Heather, but at some point the blizzard must have died down, because I heard Nikki and Dana rushing up. They said something to me, but I don't remember what. I don't even remember crying. I was just in a daze, and I stayed like that for a long time. Everything is essentially a blur in my memory for quite a while from this point. Somehow, someone took Heather from me and I found my way back through the forest to the lodge. Later on, I had learned that Nikki and Dana had tried to track the Washuge down, but had lost his trail and pulled back. The monster was severely injured, at least. I returned to the U.S., but not to Washington. I didn't want to deal with the memories there. Instead, I went all the way back to Oklahoma and showed up on my mom's doorstep in the dead of night. I did not have much to say to her. She knew what had happened, and after cooking me some chicken noodle soup, she put me to bed in the guest room. Sometime that night, I woke up to use the bathroom. When I was walking back to the bed, I think my brain expected to see Heather laying there. But of course she wasn't, and she never would be again. That was what opened the floodgates, and the first time since Heather's death, I cried. I spent the rest of the night sitting there on the floor sobbing until the sun came up, and I finally, mercifully, fell asleep. Like I said earlier, much of this time is hazy in my memory. Sometimes the brain just covers up experiences that are so traumatic and hard to handle, and I've definitely blotted a lot out. I spent most of my days sleeping, crying, or just staring into space. The hardest part was the memories that came back to haunt me constantly, and not just the memories of Heather's death or of the Washuge hunt. Although those certainly were there too, but all the experiences Heather and I had together kept coming back to me, good and bad. When she'd taken me to visit Ireland, or when we'd argue over what movie to watch, or when we'd nap together in the woods. It all kept surging back into my head, bringing waves of emotion and sending me deeper into a pit of depression and loneliness. I have tried doing something to distract myself from these memories, and eventually I did just that. But at first I could barely bring myself to get out of bed, and the idea of doing much more than that was unthinkable. It wasn't just the loneliness that was destroying me either. It was the fact that, on some level, this was my fault. Heather and I, both raised as hunters, we each had been taught for as long as we could remember about the danger of our job. We know that each task might be our last. We know when we began our relationship that we both could lose each other at any time we went into the field. But none of this made the loss any less painful, especially knowing that I was partially responsible for it in some way. I was the one that had chosen to go after the Washuge, after we had ambushed it in the hollow, and I could not stop thinking that if I had just been a little less stupid, Heather might still be alive. Even today, over a decade later, that thought still crops up in my mind from time to time. Remembering the beginning of this letter, when I talked about how I wish the hunters had more mental health support, well, this experience is what really made me think about that firsthand. Because you can't just go to any random therapist to talk about the problems the hunters face, and it's not like our organization has mental health professionals that work for us full-time. So almost the only people I had to talk to were my family, and many hunters can't even turn to their own families. I'm lucky that I was able to turn to mine, and they understood me and did everything they could to help. Over many conversations, I eventually managed to explain what had happened during the Washuge hunt to my mother, father, older sister, and some of our nation's elders that my mom's side of the family had been in contact with forever. They all helped me to realize that Heather's death was not entirely my fault. After all, Heather and I made all of our decisions together. We had both agreed to go on the hunt in the first place, and to keep chasing the Washuge after the ambush. Yes, maybe if we had chosen differently, the outcome might have changed, but we had done the best we could at the time. That is what they told me, and that is what I tell myself when I start thinking about whatever mistakes I might have made. Heather and I did the best we could. To hope for anything more would be unrealistic and foolish, and sometimes things just don't go the way we plan. Thinking about all this made me feel a little bit better. But it still took a lot of tears and a lot of time to process Heather's death. I think I'm probably still processing it, honestly. The next big step along this road came up in the winter of 2009, just over a year after Heather's death. I had not been on a single hunt for a cryptid in all that time. I had told Sergio that I just needed a break, and that I would get in touch with him when I was ready to start back up. Luckily, we hunters are paid well, and I had more than enough funds to save up to live comfortably while I recovered. In all honesty, I was considering giving up my title as a capital H hunter entirely. I'd spent close to 10 years doing my job with Heather at my side, and the prospect of going back at it alone was lonely and even a bit scary. If it had not been for Sergio calling me towards the end of 2009, I don't know what would have happened. But call me he did. And as much of a surprise as that was, it was what he told me that really made my heart race. The Washuge was back, and this was not some other member of the species as I had initially suspected. No, this was the same creature that we had found in Saskatchewan more than a year ago. This was the same monsters whose eyes I had put out. This was the thing that had killed Phil, that had killed Heather. This time it was in the woods of Quebec. First, a team of environmental scientists had reported losing some of their data in a freak snowstorm. Then a lone hunter had come across the Washuge itself near an empty cabin in the high forest. He had taken refuge in the cabin. Inside was a working phone that he used to report his encounter to the lodge before going missing. In his report, he had distinctly mentioned that the creature's skull was charred and blackened, and that one of its eyes was no more than a dark socket. Sergio had called me as soon as he had gotten the news. I try not to personalize hunts, but this was different. This was my chance for revenge. This monster had taken Heather and had made me suffer more than I had ever. This was my chance to make it suffer. A lot of the stories I was told growing up have lessons about how revenge and hatred are bad things to carry around inside of you, how they can destroy you from within. A lot of those lessons came back to me as I thought about facing the Washuge again. But this time, this literal monster, a being which can only know how to hunt and cause pain and suffering, it needed to stop, and I had to stop it from doing that. At the very least, I had the chance to stop it from taking anyone else's life like it had taken Heather's. And if I got my own personal revenge while doing so, then that would be even better. I responded to Sergio with one request. I would hunt the Washuge once again, but only if I had the chance to do so alone. Any other hunters who responded to the case could be nearby, even on standby, but I wanted to be the one to face this thing alone. I wanted the opportunity to kill it myself. I knew the foolishness of my request. What I was asking for was reckless and selfish at best, and potentially suicidal at worst. But if I was going to die, I could not think of too many better ways to go down. And I was hoping that maybe revenge would make things even the slightest bit better for me. Initially, Sergio, of course, tried to talk me out of it. He even yelled at me that doing things like this was not going to bring Heather back to life, even if I succeeded. But I had my mind made up, no matter how irrational and selfish I was acting. Eventually, I think Sergio took pity on me. "I was debating whether I should even have offered you this job," he told me. "I'm glad you did," I told him. "I'm sure you are. I cannot believe I'm doing this, but fine. I'll ask if you can do this solo. At least, this way you won't get anyone but yourself in trouble," he replied. I knew the lodge probably would not accept my request, but you never know if you don't try. Soon enough, Sergio got back to me. The lodge, by some miracle, had approved my request. The only condition was that the rest of the hunters who had answered the distress call needed to be within a half of a mile of me at all times, ideally forming a defensive perimeter if possible. I was fine with this, and I doubted I'd be able to negotiate even if I wasn't. A half mile was honestly a very generous distance. I'd have plenty of room to work and to fight. I took the job and didn't even give my family the details. All I said was goodbye and that I loved them. I did not consult the elders either. I just thanked them for their help, and after that I headed out north once again. I was fully committed. This time, it was going to be either the Washuge or me. Upon arriving in Quebec, I immediately went to rendezvous with the other hunters who had taken the job. We chose to meet at the cabin where the lone hunter had called in the Washuge, and then had gone missing. When I arrived, I found three other hunters a short distance away from the cabin, waiting for me to arrive to start the investigation. I was a bit surprised to find Dana from the previous Washuge hunt there. I had not expected her, but then again, she wasn't very far away. The other two hunters were named Eric and Francis. Both were muscular white guys with long hair and beards who I later learned were also Canadian. To be perfectly honest, I don't remember much about them. I'm a little ashamed to say that, because I ordinarily try to get to know my teammates at least a little. This time, though, my thoughts were focused almost entirely on the hunt. We started by investigating the cabin. The front door had been knocked off its hinges and was laying on the floor inside the foyer. A few of the cabin windows had been cracked or shattered, maybe from the force of the wind or flying debris. The inside of the place was generally clean and well-furnished, so it was probably somebody's summer home. That explained the working phone that the missing hunter had used to make the report. There was no cell coverage this far out. As for the hunters themselves, their fate was quite clear. Blood was splashed across the walls, the furniture, and the carpeted floor of the living room. But there was far too much red for any human to have lost and survived. It was likely that some of the blood was the Washugae's, but when we left the cabin, the cryptid's trail was plain to see. Just like Saskatchewan, an obvious trail of collapsed trees and snapped branches led off to the east through the forest. You couldn't have asked for a better trail. I won't walk you through every detail of the days we spent following the Washugae, but the basic format of how we traveled was pretty much in line with what I had expected. During the day, I traveled ahead of everyone else, tracking the Washugae on my own. Even though the others were only a half mile behind me, I still left them markers to follow my trail in case they lost it. Like in Saskatchewan, the trail of damaged tree eventually stopped, and I had to follow the Washugae mainly by finding its prints in the snow. By drawing arrows in the snow or cutting obvious marks into conspicuous trees, I was able to mark the trail for my fellow hunters to follow. Before the sun began to set, I would stop and let the others catch up to me, and we would all camp together for the night, taking turns on watch. Then as it began to get light, I would eat quickly, grab my things, and head out to start tracking once more. The whole process repeated for a few days, as we were following the target through the forest and down into a large valley. Quebec is a very beautiful place even in the winter. Several times, I came across the site of a kill or a chase where the Washugae had ambushed or run down some unfortunate animal. I never heard or saw any of these attacks occur, though, and I always arrived to the scene, blood and feathers or fur all over the snow, with the Washugae and its victim both long gone. Each time I found this, I got a little angrier and a little more disheartened. I was not getting any closer. At least it did not feel like it anyway. At some point, I began to notice something disturbing about the Washugae's trail. If I was remembering the landscape correctly, I was starting to make a circle. The Washugae had begun to loop around, counterclockwise. I was starting to consider this when I thought of a frightening possibility based on something I learned long ago. African buffalo are known for their aggressiveness and are said to sometimes do something similar to what I was observing with the Washugae. When I was in Tanzania, I had been told that if a lone buffalo encounters a predator, they may drive them off, then make a huge circle to come around and hit the threat from behind when they least expect it. I don't know if this is true or not, or just a myth, but it jumped to my mind when I noticed the path the Washugae was taking. Something in my gut told me I was onto something, and that I needed to turn back. I did exactly that, retracing my steps, meeting up with Dana, Eric, and Francis. When I told them my realization and my explanation for it, Francis actually laughed in my face. Dana and Eric were more willing to consider the possibility. Dana, at least, knew firsthand how fast this creature was and how quickly it could get around behind us if we weren't expecting it. I had a plan, though, and as the sun began to set, I explained it. I was going to set a trap. I had the rest of the group head back the way I came from, so that we switched places. Now, they were further ahead on the Washugae's trail than I was, and I was behind them. If the Washugae was going to circle back to us like I predicted, then it would come to me first. I was the first one the cryptid would encounter, and that was just what I wanted. A lone target without a fire would be more attractive to the Washugae than a trio of armed humans with a fire and a shelter, or so I hoped. I found a good spot in a clearing at the edge of a little wash. A wash is a small ravine or gorge where the water flows. This wash was no more than 5 feet deep and filled about halfway with frozen water. On the opposite side of the clearing from the wash was a little ridge. I decided to lay and wait there. I set my ground trap, my sleeping pad, and my sleeping bag right in the center of the clearing, making it as obvious as possible. I even took branches and pine needles and fallen leaves and stuffed them in my sleeping bag to make it look like I was sleeping inside of it. I was hoping the whole time that the Washuge wasn't somewhere nearby watching me. If it was, then this would be all for nothing. By the time I was finished setting up, the sun had disappeared. I think I briefly considered lighting a small fire to attract the Washuge's attention, but realized that might provoke it to attack from afar with the icicles. I needed this thing to come in close, so without making a fire, I took my weapons, left my pack by my sleeping bag, and went up the nearby slope to settle in and wait. There was only a light breeze at first, and the visibility was rather good, with the crescent moon giving off pretty good light in the area. Everything was silent except for the occasional rustling of pine needles or leaves in the wind. My ears were straining to hear anything out of the ordinary, and even though I couldn't see very well at a long distance, my eyes were peeled for any unusual movement. My thoughts kept veering back to Saskatchewan, to Texas, to Libya, and a dozen other hunts where I had been in this same sort of situation, but with Heather by my side. I missed her a lot more on that night, but each of the many times I thought of her, I did my best to turn my focus back to the present by concentrating on my breath and my five senses. After a while, my efforts were rewarded. I heard the crunch of snow somewhere off to the right side of the clearing. I took a deep breath and turned to see the pinprick of a single yellow eye, glowing well over 10 feet above the ground in the shadows. For a moment, the Washuge appeared to just stand there, observing the clearing and probably calculating its next move. I could have fired at it then, but I wanted to come out into the open before I shot. I wanted to be sure I had it. A few moments passed, and the hide of the Washuge's eye lowered several feet. It was crouching. Then it sprang forwards on all fours, faster than seemed possible. It made a cry or some sort of roar as it leapt forward, snapping through branches and picking up snow. In only 2 or 3 bounds, it was on the sleeping bag, crouching over it and mauling it frantically and horrifically with fast swipes of its clawed hands. Then it picked up the biggest piece of the bag in both of its hands, raised it to its mouth, and bit down on it, driving the saber teeth of its wolf skull right through the polyester in insulation. Then it froze, going entirely still for an instant. This must have been when it realized what was going on, because a moment later, it opened its jaws impossibly wide and gave a howl of rage that sounded partially human. It raised the remains of the sleeping bag over its head in both hands and began to smash them into the ground, beating and pounding the snow with enough force that I even felt it vibrate through my body. It was acting like a child throwing a tantrum, and that made me feel a strange mixture of revulsion, anger, and even pity, somehow. But I knew my chance was coming, so I continued to wait. After about a minute of raging, the Washuge tossed the scraps of the sleeping bag away and stood up to its full height. It paused for a moment, and I knew it was time to strike. I aimed for the Washuge's head with my rifle and fired. Plumes of smoke burst out across the Washuge's skull, lighting up the darkness, and the monster stumbled backwards, trying to bat the fire off of its head. It had started to spread across its upper half of its body. I rose to my feet as I got into the last few rounds in my rifle. For a moment, I saw the Washuge's lone eye settle onto me. The creature stepped towards me, its mane and torso still blazing, and I saw it snap off a huge icicle from one of its shoulders. I dove to the side and felt the rush of air go past me as the icicle missed me. I made another dive back the way I came and snapped my rifle barrel up to the Washuge rushing me. I fired my last round at its face, and somehow, one of my last shots stopped the Washuge dead in its tracks. Its remaining eye went dark, and it raised its hands to its face, screaming another partially human cry. It was still burning, and now that it was blind, I had the best opportunity yet to end this. I dropped my rifle, picked up my shotgun, which I had been waiting for a moment just like this to use. The Wushuge was stumbling around blindly, swatting at the flames that were rolling across its upper half of its body. As I approached, it swung out at me, but I was much too far away. I could have finished the cryptid off from a much greater distance with rifle rounds, but I wanted to be close. I wanted the Wushuge to burn. As I got closer, close enough to feel the heat of the flames coming off of the thrashing Wushuge, I raised my shotgun and pulled the trigger. The dragon's breath ammo sent a jet of flames rushing out of the barrel, igniting the Washuge's legs and lower half. It screamed again, a high-pitched, blood-curdling sound. And this time, it kept screaming. The sound made my stomach turn, and I felt sudden, frigid tears rolling down my face as I kept firing. Each flaming shot added more fire to the inferno that was consuming the Washuge, until finally, the creature's screams died out and it collapsed into the snow, twitching a few more times before falling still. I dropped my shotgun and took a few aimless steps before crumpling and bursting into exhausted, relieved tears. I still can't tell you exactly why I started crying on that night. Maybe I was crying for the monster I had just killed, which may have once been human. Maybe I was crying for Heather, who wasn't there to celebrate the victory with me. Maybe I was crying because Sergio was right. Getting revenge didn't bring Heather back, and I still miss her. It has now been over a decade since I killed the Wushuge, and thankfully I never had to hunt one again. I went back to my family in Oklahoma and told them about my second Wushuge hunt in full detail. Predictably, they were angry at me for acting alone, even though they understood why I had done it. I acknowledged my behavior as having been selfish and risky and apologized for it. Everyone forgave me eventually, although it took a few years before my mother did so. To say that I gained nothing from my revenge mission against the Wushuge would be silly. I gained revenge, the satisfaction of destroying the thing that had destroyed such a huge part of my life. But at the same time, it didn't give me what I really wanted. Heather is still dead, and nothing will change that. Killing the Wushuge made her loss a little bit more bearable, but it was still a lot of effort and a lot of danger for only a little personal payoff. At least I helped to protect a lot of innocent lives, but I could have done it in a much safer and less self-centered way. Think before you act, everyone, and use your head as well as your heart. It may not be a matter of life and death, but it may just make a big difference. And as cliche as it might sound, the future holds lots of possibilities. If you've listened to my previous letters, you may have already noticed that I've mentioned having a girlfriend. Her name is Serena, and I met her a few years ago now. She's a veterinarian, and no, she's not a hunter. I guess I'm just drawn to women with high-stress jobs that are all about saving lives. Serena listens to these letters and proofreads them for me along with my nephew before I send them into Swamp Dweller. She's incredibly intelligent, with a will of steel and a huge heart, and I like her a lot. Serena is a lot like Heather, but she's not Heather, and I've learned to accept that. Anyway, that's enough sappy stuff for one letter. I think, well, one last thing. This letter has been a lot about my personal experience with grief and depression, and to be completely honest, those are issues that will probably affect you far more than any cryptid. Mental illness can be just as dangerous as any claws or fangs. I didn't really have any professional help with my struggles, but things are different for us hunters. There's a lot of help available if you just reach out. If you're struggling, ask for help. You might be surprised by the outcome. That's all for now, though. The next letter will be my last, so if you have any final questions or comments, be sure to speak up so that I can see what you have to say. As always, I'll be reading your comments, even if I can't address them all. Otherwise, stay safe, stay healthy. We'll talk more soon. This has been Sam White Owl. Signing out.